Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of this episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Wow, I love doing that. It makes me feel really cool.
Saying our names.
Saying it like this.
You are way inordinately proud of our ability to say our names.
No, I'm just inordinately proud of my ability to talk on the radio like I used to hear it when I was a kid. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Your intros remind me every Saturday and put a big smile on my face what Sean Connery answered Johnny Carson. Your wife's lipstick. It just makes me smile.
What? What'd you say? Oh, we don't want to talk about that. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much. It's a family show. Do you know that joke that he's talking about?
No, but...
Johnny Carson is a little before your time, right?
Well, I remember Johnny Carson.
You
yeah,
do?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I remember
Jack Parr.
I don't remember Ed Sullivan or Jack Parr.
Oh. I remember I saw the Beatles for the first time on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Mm-hmm.
And my... father and stepmother, I was watching them, and they ushered me out of the room.
Shameful stuff.
Yes.
This rock music with guitars.
Yeah, well, actually, I had seen Elvis on there, too. So
and his hips were gyrating.
No, they
were still gyrating.
You couldn't see it. No, the joke that is being referred to here is Sean Connery was wearing a kilt on mm-hmm. the Johnny Carson show. And he said, "What do you wear under the kilt?"
And he said, "Your wife's lipstick."
Yes.
Oh, that's horrible. Horrible.
He said it on TV, and he got away with it. So I guess that's cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number is in here: 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
There's a lot of things going on. I'm kind of
looking at the northern United States. We're talking about.
How do you look at the northern United States? It's cold up there.
Yeah, it's very cold. But Detroit is in a lot of trouble. That's something I wanted to talk about, and you were just reading a story about that.
Wall Street Journal.
The state is taking over the city, basically. They're saying you are about to fail completely.
A bankruptcy trustee for a city.
Yes.
Well, it hasn't officially happened yet, but they're
happening. It will be happening.
Yeah, the city of Detroit will declare bankruptcy.
It has been a foregone conclusion for, I don't know, since General Motors and Chrysler went bankrupt. It's not something that we've been going, I wonder what's going to happen to Detroit. No, we kind of knew it's happening. They cannot shrink the size of their bureaucracy in Detroit fast enough to keep up with the shrinking revenue. They just can't do it.
Yeah, and this is a little, some people, and it's made kind of big ongoing news. It's happening in slow motion, so Detroit has been there. But what's really interesting to me is the Securities and Exchange Commission has brought securities fraud charges against the state of Illinois.
Oh.
The whole darn state.
Yes, when the Securities Exchange Commission says to the state, you've been lying, it's not a good thing. It's really not all that great. Illinois is kind of well known for its governors going to prison shortly after not being governor anymore, and sometimes while they're still governor, but the whole state going to prison or paying a settlement is still a bit insane,
well,
if you ask me.
The reality is that the entire Illinois public pension system is probably not going to make it.
Yes, and the governor, as well as the people in charge of the finances for the pension, have been repeatedly saying to everyone, everything is fine here. I don't know what you're talking about.
You know
about.
That's exactly what happened at Enron.
Yep. That's the only thing that they actually were able to convict the head people at Enron over, is lying to the shareholders. Well, how are you going to convict politicians for lying to them?
Well, actually,
they'd all go to jail.
Well, most of them have already gone to jail, but they're basically filing the securities fraud charges that they're filing. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Illinois, which is effectively coasting towards bankruptcy, would then have to pay a big fine as they coast toward. That does,
there's some problems there. Your pension fund is almost out of money, and you're in trouble for lying about that. So pay us some money. Oh yeah.
By the way, last year, World Gold Council reported the reason that gold prices went up officially, and we were saying this: central banks, largely China, but also, and there's another one, a couple of others this year, raised purchases by 17% last year, the most since 1964. And there's another little interesting thing. Russia and Kazakhstan are increasing their holdings. They're buying gold on the open market. Now, okay, well, Russia and Kazakhstan are buying gold on the open market. Those are two of the biggest gold producers on the planet. And they're buying gold, which kind of suggests that they're probably trying to prop up the price of gold so that their gold in the ground can continue to be worth as much as they say it's worth. So it's I don't know, those of you who've listened to this for a while, I was saying a while back that I had finally figured out why the price of gold has gone up as long as it has. Of course, it's been going down now for some time. But why it went up didn't make any sense to me in light of the fact that it went down during economic downturns. And as we started into recovery and things began to get better, the price of gold kept rising. And it turned out that the answer is it's because of certain governments in Asia, including Russia and Kazakhstan and China, purchasing great quantities of gold.
Something else, since we're talking Illinois, we're talking gold. This is an amazing segue. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I don't know what you're thanking me for.
U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Oh, wow. That sounds really geeky.
Yes. They...
CFTC.
Yes.
U.S. CFTC.
Yes. They have spent some money and time going to the same folks in Britain, same banks that have just been fined massive amounts of money from...
For the LIBOR. Yes.
The Federal Reserve fining.
Right. Well, I was hoping you'd get that story.
Yes. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission is now going to those same banks who are the ones that set the price of gold, not what we quote usually. What we usually quote is a futures price, a contract on future price of gold. What is the, what we would call the spot price, is set by the same banks that set the LIBOR, which is the thing that just got, because they were able to set the price, they were able to make profits on the price because they knew what the price was going to be before other people did. With commodities, particularly raw commodities, not the contract on a commodities, it's not illegal to corner the market or to manipulate the market. However, the Commodities Future Trading Commission is now starting an investigation, not an official investigation. We're investigating, but this is not an official investigation. What is that supposed to mean, by the way?
Ex libis.
We're saying, we're investigating this publicly. They say it in a press conference. But this is not an official investigation.
Right. Are you an official investigator? Are you investigating?
Okay, they're investigating.
Yes, but I only do it on weekends.
Right, they're investigating the setting of the price of gold. The reason why I don't that I believe that it's not an official investigation is because there's not really an international law out there that says they're not allowed to set the price of gold wherever they want it.
Well, but it affects the thing about the setting, and I read up on the thing about setting the spot price of gold is it affects the closing price on the contracts, which the Futures Trading Corporation.
Correct. And which is why they
does control.
They believe that there's some ability there for them to exert their control. And there's an old, I think it was in the 1916 era, there was a law passed that hasn't been unpassed. And I have to look at the exact date. It was sometime in the 1910s.
I think they call it. It's not unpassed. It's peeling again.
Yes. It's not been repealed.
Yes.
But it's not been used in a long time because we don't use our currency and gold prices in the same sentence anymore.
Right.
But they're thinking maybe they could use something in that to say, no. Hey, you're not allowed to fix gold prices and so on.
Interestingly enough, some of those banks that are involved in the setting of the price of gold, guess who some of their biggest depositors are?
Oh, wait. I'm guessing it has to do with gold. The Chinese, the Russians, the South Africans.
The Kazakhstanis, yes. And oh, my. How could, oh, who would have ever thought? Oh, my.
Goodness, goodness gracious.
Let
so
let us wring our hands. Ding.
As if we didn't have enough reason to be cautious in the gold and commodities market, and those of you that have been listening for any number of years have heard us say it is possible to make large quantities of money in gold, but that you must approach it very cautiously, and you must also recognize that where money is made is it consistently made is when you create a value, when you create utility, and gold does not do that. It is pure gambling.
Look, there is a lot of money that can be made in buying and selling gold as a dealer.
You make a commission
both ways.
Up and down. It's like
gold goes up, we make a money. Gold goes down, we make a money.
It's like the casinos. They make money. If you're playing poker in their casino, they're not playing poker with you, but they make money no matter who wins.
Right.
Every hand of poker, they make money. This is a gold dealer. This is the same concept. They make money no matter if the price is up or down.
It's a coin flip, though, really. It's heads, I win.
Tails, you lose.
No, tails, I win.
Yes. Heads, I win. Tails, you lose.
No. Tails, I win. Heads, I win.
That means the same thing.
I'm not even worried about your losing. Anyway.
I win. It's a win-win situation. I win both ways.
That's it. You got it. Oh, there's something else. The Federal Reserve, for those of you who follow these things, if you don't follow these things, it still happened, put all the major banks.
Should we warn people that don't follow these? You can stop listening now.
You don't need to be listening anymore.
All right, okay.
The Federal Reserve had all of the major banks in the United States. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, about 20 banks, had them all get on a treadmill and hooked up electrodes to them.
Yes, watch their heart rates.
And did a stress test. Isn't that neat?
Yeah. They sweat money.
Yeah. And by a stress test, they basically run a scenario of a worst-case situation where, for example, the euro collapses. The government shuts down. Of course, it's very unlikely that these things would ever happen, that the Congress would deadlock and not pass the budget, and the government would shut down, and that would trigger instability, which would cause the euro to collapse.
What do you mean? Did you just say very unlikely that this
is? Of course. No one would ever dream of such a
thing. Why would the American government shut down? They've got plenty of money coming, and people are trying to loan them money all over the world.
Congress passes a budget a year in advance.
So yeah, I mean, this should never be a
piece of cake. Anyway.
If you can hear sarcasm, you are hearing it right now.
Anyway, they went through there and did their thing and tested the banks, and most of them did okay. BB&T, what's BB&T? I don't remember what that is, but that's a major bank. BB&T plan was rejected, and they haven't resubmitted, so they are kind of in deep difficulties, to say the least. There are two banks that are kind of put in provisional position as being worrying, J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs.
Are they worrying? Or are they?
They were given conditional approval of their capital and plan, but they have very narrow rules they have to follow. They have to approve it within a fairly short period of time. The bank that came out on top that was the best of the best by far, and looking at their capital reserves is pretty astonishing how good it is, was the Bank of New York Mellon. To give you some idea, the reserves of J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, you go down to these banks, Wells Fargo has tier one reserves of 5.56%. Bank of New York Mellon has tier one reserves of 13.21%.
Yeah, that's a lot of reserves.
And the tier two reserves are equally differential in their area. So what you have is, and it's in the papers. I got this actually out of Financial Times today. It's in there online. You don't have to get a subscription to see it. It's in the Wall Street Journal. It is worth looking at, because what that means is, if you are relying on that bank to hold your money or your funds or you're relying on a subsidiary of that bank or something, any bank that's on there, the larger their reserves, the larger their Tier 1 and Tier 2 levels are in there, the better the probabilities are that that bank will stay stable and not shut down. Obviously, the smaller banks come and go, and that's a little different issue altogether. But these are these banks that they looked at very, very hard are basically the ones that if they were to fail, would be really, really the government would have to step in and basically bail them out. What was Bank of America passed 8.42% reserves. Let's see, what are some of the others? State Street passed, Citigroup passed.
Basically, the state of our banking system is strong, saying.
Basically said that we got two banks that are questionable, major banks that the government might have to step in and bail out in case of a worst-case scenario.
If you just think back to 2007, same situation. Who would have to be bailed out? Everybody.
No, not quite everybody.
Not everybody. You're right. But
Bank of New York
didn't need a bailout on everybody. Yeah, all but everybody. Yeah. One or two banks were like, oh, we don't need it. And even those banks, Bank of America at that point, was saying we don't need the bailout. And then they were told that they needed to buy.
Well, they also changed their minds because they bought Countrywide.
Countrywide was purchased. Well, that's why I'm saying. The Federal Reserve said to Bank of America, you're the only one capable of buying this, who's willing to buy this, so you need to buy this. And they said they bought it. And then they said, whoa, there's a lot more losses than we thought on the books here. And the Federal Reserve and the United States government came and said, here, have some money for a while.
Well, this is incidentally, this is one of those things that happens after a financial crisis that's good. Some aspects of the bills that were passed, and particularly the Dodd-Frank bill, are not the most pleasant things in the world to many people. One of the things that was passed by Congress is a requirement to go in and stress test banks that are the biggest banks in the United States, the ones that we cannot afford. First Secretary of the Treasury and the Federal Reserve have to identify the banks that, in the event that bank were to fail,
it could bring down the whole system.
Yeah, it could bring down the whole system. So the too big to fail rule, if you will. And if they're too big to fail, then they have to undergo, I think it's an annual stress test supervised by the Federal Reserve. And they have to pass it, or they can't pay dividends, they can't give out bonuses. Basically, they hold their feet to the fire.
And what's more important, I think our listeners will agree with this, is not only will they not be able to give out dividends, they won't be able to do a lot of the things that they normally would do for their shareholders, but the most important thing is that the caps on executive pay are in place.
And there's no bonuses.
No bonuses and cap on pay, which is like $200,000, which to most of us is, well, that's a lot. That's a pretty good amount of money. And to them is, oh, no, how will I eat? I won't be able to buy my caviar every night.
Typically, at the high level of these banks, their bonuses are multiples of their annual pay.
Yes. So that's probably the biggest incentive, which makes us think that if there was a cap on salaries in Congress, they might actually pass a budget.
This year, you will not
be paid unless you pass a budget.
Right.
Because we're going to shut down the government, and it's your job to make sure the government isn't shut down, and therefore you're not doing your job.
They passed an omnibus spending bill. By the way, if the government shuts down on the 27th, at the end of the month, members of Congress don't get paid.
Well, that's nice to know at least.
I don't know that it will have a great deal of effect on them, but they won't get paid. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. As you see that BP is now suing to block settlement payments that were made with a new formula in January.
Well, I think personally the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico had some effect on our business. I'm not sure what it is.
I don't know. Let's go see if we can find some methodology of getting involved.
It coincided with a downturn in the market.
Right. So, yeah, that's probably
it. Obviously, it was the fault of BP, and they should pay us $2 million, don't you think?
Yes. What is at stake here is that originally they're not called British Petroleum anymore, they're called BP, estimated that it was going to owe, at the time of the settlement, they estimated it was going to owe about $7.1 billion, which is a lot of money. Last year at this point, they estimated that it was going to be $8.1 billion. Now they don't know. They are unable to give a calculation because new formulas are being used, which include a lot of damages that they're saying were not part of the settlement. So they're suing. We'll wait and see what happens there, but it could be that they're looking at $12 or $14 billion in damages with the new method of calculation, which I think is a little bit exorbitant.
No, it's probably a lot exorbitant.
I think the concept of when we start talking about $7 billion or $14 billion, I think people lose track of what we're talking about here. The cleanup and the damages done by the spill. Known cleanup costs were in the tens of millions of dollars. Tens of millions of dollars, okay? Multiply that times 100 and you get $1 billion. Multiply it times 200 or 300 or 700 times. 700 times the cost of cleanup is $7 billion, which is what BP originally thought it was going to spend here. Now we're talking about thousands of times the damage cleanup to pay this, and people are looking at it going, well, they did the mess, they should clean it up. Well, yeah, I'm all for if you break it, you buy it. I am absolutely for that. If somebody comes along in a semi-truck and plows into a building that I own, they should pay for the repair. They should even pay some damages beyond the repair for my lost business. So, okay, let's move that damage figure up. $7.1 billion actually makes some sense because there was damage to businesses. But when we're talking about twice that amount, you're getting into an area that is so crazy. The numbers involved here boggle my mind. And we hear it on the radio and we hear it on the news regularly. We hear $14 billion there. We talk about the U.S. government budget of $3.2 or $3.6 trillion. And we think, whoa, trillion, billion. That's a lot of money. Anyway. I'm going to wait and see how this turns out, but it's one of those things where we may be putting a company out of business for doing something that was admittedly dumb, but didn't cause enough damage to put the company out of business. And we may be putting them out of business anyway.
Yep, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach.
We have
some
gonna break
commercials. Telephone numbers to call in here on the other side of commercials, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Stand by to spa. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400.
And let's see what else is going on in the big wide world. I have some people come in and say, well, if the market is up so much, why is my portfolio not up as much as the market? People have been asking that question.
Well, it depends on the market. Really, really does.
No, I mean,
depends on how you're invested. There's a lot of other things that come in. Just because you're in the market doesn't mean you are the market.
Well, one of the things that there's a tendency to do at this point, we are in what I would refer to as a nascent bull market. Even though historically, we're going to look back and see the bull market started in 2009, but we are in what's called the great turnover, which occurs once in a great while. The last major one of these that we had was back around 1994. And there's a lot of similarities between now and then. At about that point, people began to go out of bonds and into stocks. And the more people got out of bonds and into the stocks, because they were losing money in bonds and they were making money in stocks. And the more they got out of bonds and into stocks, the higher stocks went. And the higher stocks went, the more people said, the market's going up. I need to get in. But they very gradually got in, and then they began to pour in. We mentioned earlier, this year to date, for the first time since, I think, 2008, it's 2007, actually, the cash flows are positive for equity mutual funds in the United States.
Yeah. What does that mean? It means that more money has gone into equity mutual funds, equity being stocks,
than has come out. And that's despite the fact we're up like 107, last week was 117% since the bottom in the Dow or in the S&P 500. Now, what's happened is people are not taking money out of bonds yet, although we are seeing some of that in municipal bonds. People are getting a little skittish there. They're beginning to take money out. We've seen some declines. But we're not seeing a big exodus from the bond market yet, and I think it'll be a little while before we see that. People will have to lose some significant money there before they start bolting for the woods. And
right, because bonds are supposed to be safe. That's why people are going to bonds. One of the things, I'm not meaning to interrupt, but just to give kind of a historical note here. Human behavior has us doing the wrong thing in the market so often that it is it's nearly laughable how consistent it is. When the bond market is overpriced, people tend to put more money into it. And when the stock market is overpriced, people tend to put more money into it. When the stock market is underpriced, people tend to take money out of it, and the same with the bond market. When it's underpriced, people take money out of it. That's the reverse of what everyone involved with the market knows you're supposed to do to make money. You buy low and sell high, except that human behavior has us very nervous doing that. It's a lot easier to jump into something that's doing well.
Yeah.
It's doing well, so I'm going to buy it. And those of you that are gainfully employed and have 401ks or 403bs, just think about the normal way that you and your coworkers choose the positions in your 401k or 403b. You look at the track record for the last 5 and 7 years and you say, what's doing the best? Or you look at the 3-year period or the 1-year period and you say, oh, these ones are doing really well. I'm going to get into those. That's the normal way people choose investments. That's the wrong way to choose investments. What it's frustrating to us because we know this, and the data that you're provided with by these companies is only performance data. You have to do a lot of research to know that there's other things involved. Just because it's done well doesn't mean it's a buy, doesn't mean it's a sell. There's further research that's necessary. Unfortunately, it's outside the realm of most people's experience. Anyway, you may continue now.
Well, for example, we've been hooting about the dangers in municipal debt. By the way,
we hoot a lot.
Yes,
and
we are
a hoot.
I want to point out something. Most municipal debt in the United States is probably going to experience reduced risk in the not very far distant future.
What that means is that after the risk is over, we'll have less risk?
No, because the housing market is coming back, which means the local property taxes will begin to come
back.
Very
good.
There are exceptions to that, though. For example, California and Illinois and Detroit, among others.
And
so it's a case where having to be very careful about what you're doing there. And then you throw in the fact that as interest rates go up, bonds go down, and you get a lot of very interesting interactions. But let's look at general municipal debt. This is according to the Wall Street Journal. Over the last 5 years has averaged, last 3 years has averaged, if you just had a general municipal debt mutual fund, you've had an average annual gain of 6.28% per year. And you're saying, goodness gracious, you know, as scary as things are, that's where I need to leave my money. And, you know, municipal, intermediate term municipal debt, last 3 years is up 4.44, last 5 years up 4.58. Very consistent return. People are probably very, very happy with that. And that makes, you know, that makes for a lot of sense from the perspective of somebody who's saying, this has done well, so I probably need to stay with it. And, of course, just as long-term U.S. Treasury government bond to the average mutual fund is up all around roughly 5% a year for the last several years. However, for the last 12 months, that same long-term U.S. Treasury government bond is down 1% with everything reinvested. That's not a lot to notice, but it is a reversal of the trend. And one of the things that a good portfolio would, in my opinion, when interest rates are very, very low and you got a lot of gains, and over the last 3 to 5 years there's a lot of gains, then a good portfolio manager begins to move money towards shorter duration bonds, which pay lower interest rates, which causes everybody to be a little bit nervous.
When we say duration, a lot of people don't know what we're talking about, and this is not exactly true, and it's certainly not...
What makes you think I know what we're talking about?
Duration is a little bit more difficult to calculate, but an easy method of looking is just looking at maturity date. If you're close to maturity, then it's less risk than if you're further away.
And so,
we look at duration because it's a more finite way of tracking risk in a bond, but it's harder to calculate.
Basically, it's moving to shorter maturity bonds.
And you said you didn't use algebra. If you calculate duration, you used algebra.
No, I just take other people's word for it. Somebody else calculates the duration. I don't do that calculation.
I'll calculate the duration for you.
Yeah, when you got like thousands of bonds in a portfolio and you're going to calculate the duration for the whole portfolio, I want to see you do that. Okay, but the point is that over that time period of the last several years, during the ups and downs in the market, and there have been a lot of downs in the last several years. 2011, for example, the market dropped about 16% following the budget ceiling, the debt ceiling issue. If you had those bonds in the portfolio, they smooth things out very, very nicely. They're very important to have there.
Yes, bonds are important.
Particularly if you're making or anticipating making systematic withdrawals. Now, here's where it gets interesting, though.
Oh, it wasn't interesting already? What was I listening to this for?
You got
up. Wasn't interesting.
By reducing the interest rate in that cushion area and getting very, very conservative over on that side, going for low interest rate, low coupon rate bonds is so counterintuitive. I mean, obviously, if you have a choice between a 6% interest paying bond or a 2% interest-paying bond, which would you go for? Well, people would go for the 6, except for the fact that the 6 is priced at 120 and the 2 is priced at 100. So you really do get a 2%, where in the other one you're going to lose money in all likelihood. So I know that sounds a little complicated, but this is the kind of rational behavior that people generally don't have in the markets. And at the same time, it's important to look at your portfolio. And let me give you an example. Mid-cap value funds have averaged about 7.69% over the last 5 years, which is way below their historic norms. They've averaged 12-point-something% of the last 3 years. If you have a portion of your portfolio over there, whatever portion of your portfolio, should have gotten a pretty similar return to that. If you have different pieces in your portfolio, we call those asset classes, then if you take a look at each asset class and its percentage, and you figure up each return in each area and you multiply it times the percentage, you come up with an answer. And for example, if you got 6 or 8% over the last 12 months, you're doing very well, despite the fact that the 1 year return in certain parts of the equity market is double digit at that point. Now that sounds really crazy, but the bottom line to it is, The only way to get the very high returns as the market goes up is to go 100% into whatever is the riskiest thing out there that's getting the highest return.
Right.
Which means that when, not if, it turns downward, you will go down with it. And
balancing that is what bonds do.
We're at that turnover position where people will go from being afraid of loss to afraid of missing gain. Both are bad positions. Both are equally fatal to a portfolio. Holding a steady course through the entire thing over a long period of time has shown over and over again to be the only way to go. Unfortunately,
people don't like to do that.
We're starting into that time when the bull market is cranking up and people are saying, if the market is going to get 12 or 18%, I want 12 or 18%. Why are you not getting 12 or 18%, money manager? Or they'll jump to whatever fund has got 12 to 18% of the last year.
Yeah.
And this is what you have to guard against. It's very counterintuitive to invest effectively. It means during roaring bull markets,
you have to hold things that have absolutely no chance of roaring.
Right. You'll be very happily not making as much money as the S&P 500.
But it means also much better that in down markets,
you will avoid the losses.
You don't have the massive losses.
Right.
So having that balanced approach, having a scientific reason for having that balanced approach, all of that is necessary if you're going to preserve your portfolio and actually have it grow over time.
That is true. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We're going to see if you're on the ball on that one. You weren't even taking a drink when I said that. Hey, we're not drinking.
We have commercials to play, don't we?
And we do have another set of commercials to play, but the telephone numbers to call on the other side would be 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Stand by for bankruptcy. We'll be right back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. It's about 10 minutes left in the show. And telephone numbers to call 773-1400
or 1-866-597-1400.
There's a nice little summary in the Financial Times about the general economic situation in the United States that I liked.
Which general?
You'll have to judge.
Okay.
Okay, so excluding food and energy, this inflation, core prices rose 0.2%.
That means it's positive.
Last month.
We're out of deflation.
That would average out to about 2.5% a year because of compounding, which is just about exactly what the Fed's target rate is. Isn't that amazing? Food costs were up 0.1% in February, and fruits and vegetables were up a little bit. Let's see. From 1 year ago, overall prices and core prices gained 2%. So overall, 12 months, inflation has been 2%. Now, why do I want to mention that? And it's important because any of you who were listening to Glenn Beck a few years ago, warning about runaway inflation, devaluation of the dollar, the Fed printing money, and the dollar was going to be devalued. Folks, I hate to break this to you, but the dollar has risen against other currencies during that period when he said everything was going to collapse. And we've had very, very little inflation, almost no inflation during that period, which should tell you just exactly how accurate scare tactics are. Interestingly enough, he made a lot of money selling gold while he was doing it. This is in the Financial Times, so there's an error in here, by the way. Ian Shepherdson, chief economist at Pantheon Macroeconomic Advisors. Boy, that's a mouthful. Said the petrol price jump was not the biggest concern for Americans. Petrol price? I don't think any Americans are concerned about the petrol price.
I don't buy petrol. I mean, I've gotten petrol when I was in Britain, but that's what they use to fuel their cars there. We use gasoline here.
He said that the biggest concern that they found among consumers, people who were talking about consumer spending, was fiscal tightening by the government. Again, that's the big thing. Industrial production rebounded in February. Production rose 0.7% last month. That is certainly an estimate. I mean, the economists were saying 0.4%. A 7% gain in industrial manufacturing in the United States is really very, very good, considering that it takes a tremendous capital expenditure to increase the capacity to manufacture things. This is not something that changes like consumer spending up and down quite a lot. And the mere fact that in the light of all that's going on with sequester on the horizon last month and wandering around and government spending going to be cut, and the government buys a lot of that manufactured stuff, folks, the fact that manufacturing was up last month is a sign of some fundamental health in the economy. In my opinion at least, in excellent, excellent condition.
And I have one more piece that runs in the tax area. Bill Maher, are you familiar with him?
Yes.
He's an HBO guy. He does this talk show. He's a funny guy. He's a little bit...
he's a comedian.
He's a little bit bitter for my taste. I like the Daily Show, that sort of thing. That kind of uplifting, but also jabbing at both sides of the political spectrum. Bill Maher is admittedly a liberal.
He's a little to the left of that. He makes Karl Marx look like a conservative. But anyway, go ahead.
He was on a panel recently on television and made a comment that one of his fellow liberals was talking about how Paul Ryan's budget is making a statement that rich people are paying too much taxes, and she was saying it very sarcastically. Well, Bill Maher, sitting on the panel, said, well, yeah, they are. If you look at the statistics, the top 1% or the top 5%, we're paying 70% of the taxes. And when you consider that 49% of people actually are making money from the government, they're not paying money to the government, that says something. Well, he's a liberal. And he said, this is a direct quote, liberals, you might lose me. I'm paying 50% in income taxes if you throw in... and this is my part going in forward. He lives in California.
Yeah.
If you throw in the local and sales taxes, he's paying more than 60% of his income to taxes.
I understand that.
At some point, people look around and go, wait a minute. I realize that I was saying rich people have too much money, but I'm working hard for this money. I spend a lot of time working for this money, and I'm paying 60% of it, and some people aren't paying any. Mm-hmm. You have a point where they say, wait a minute.
When Bill Maher becomes a conservative, that's going to be an interesting day.
Yeah.
We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, back in the go-go 80s, there was a guy that wrote a book. I think it was called Dow 40,000. Did you guys... You
know
what I'm talking about?
Dow 36,000, I think.
Okay. Did you guys read that?
Yeah, I read it. It'll happen.
I know that's one person's opinion, but are the premises for the Dow 36,000 today related at all?
I think basically he was right.
Yeah, the concept of if we don't have at some point a Dow 36,000, I'll just give you, this is not an opinion.
Then we won't have a Dow.
This is not an opinion. This is just a statement. We will not be the leaders of the free world anymore. We won't be the leaders of anything. If our economy doesn't continue to grow, we're going to be left behind. And right now we're at 14,000. It doesn't take much to double and a half.
Even... counting the Great Depression and everything else in, the Dow, on average, has a very, 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 very long-term rate of return of about 10%. And when you average it all out...
that doubles every 7 years.
So that means that if we have a Dow today at 15,000, for example, it's not quite, but if it was at 15,000, pretty close, then 7 years from now...
we'd be at 30.
We'd be at 30, and it isn't very far from there to 36,000.
I remember when the Dow was at 1,000. You remember it. I have a headline on an article on the Wall Street Journal, the Dow 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't that long ago. When you think about my career spans just over 20 years. 20 years, and I remember a Dow at 3,000. I remember from childhood a 1,000. So if we don't hit a Dow of 36,000, there's something seriously wrong with our country.
Yep. 30 years ago, the Dow was at 1,000. Today, it's at 15,000, 14,000, 15,000.
So it's 1,500 times its size of 30 years ago. If we can't do that again in 30 years, then we're not...
No, it's 15 times its size. 1,500%.
1,500%, yes. Yeah. I did times instead of percent. Sorry, 1,500%.
And we're on the we're on the backside of a decade of virtually no return in the Dow. I mean, the Dow was almost as high as it is today in 2000.
Correct.
So we go through these decades.
Happened in the 70s as well.
Right. Happened in the 30s, happened in the 70s, happened. We've just been through another one, another, quote, lost decade, if
every,
you want to call it that.
Every time we have one of those, the following decades are pretty amazing.
Yeah. I would not be at all surprised that 10 years from now the Dow was at 36,000.
And that sounds like somebody smoking something controlled, some controlled
but
substance.
But
we just look at history. It's not that unusual for something like that to happen.
And this comes from the fact that I do keep records, and I have noted that it was 1,000 when I started 30 years ago, and it's approaching 15,000 today, and we've had a lousy 10 years behind us, so I can expect to see it in the future. But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we've got less than a minute left in the show, so it's time for us to tell you our infomercial.
Yes, we are the Personal Wealth Coach, and we do manage portfolios. It's what we actually do for a living.
Investment portfolios.
Investment portfolios. Yeah, yeah. Yes, not photography of portfolios.
Right. Well, I do.
You manage your own.
I have a photography
portfolio.
And you have an art portfolio.
Yes, I do. Okay. But we manage for people that have enough money that they're worried about it not being around later, which kind of includes everyone. But that's we kind of specialize in the upper tax brackets. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111.
Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you may email us, Jeff or Jake, at tpwc.com.
News Station, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.